From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, religion and UFOs. Here's what's happening. Tropical storm off the Carolinas posing a massive threat to the United States. Severe weather and tropical storm hit the Gulf Coast in eastern United States, bringing dangerous conditions, thunderstorms, potential for flash flooding. As much as the western U.S. remains threatened by excessive heat, the second named storm of the Atlantic hurricane season strengthened off the eastern seaboard. Tropical Storm Bill, it's called, expected to dissipate by Wednesday over colder water as it moves north from Nantucket, Massachusetts. Let's hope so. Southwest Airlines computer issues continue Tuesday afternoon, a day after a computer glitch stranded passengers at airport terminals all around the country. In a new statement, a company spokesperson said the Southwest proactively canceled about 500 flights on Tuesday due to the issues that was working with impacted customers on how to get them to their destinations. What a hassle that would be. Huh? You're waiting for your plane and it gets canceled, and unbelievable. China's Air Force has sent 28 aircraft close to Taiwan, the largest sortie this year, further ratcheting up military pressure on the government in Taipei as it seeks to strengthen ties with the United States. I still see that as a potential problem out there. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene has claimed the coronavirus was human-made in a Chinese lab and suggested the American people were victims of bioweapons attack. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. John, I've said it was made in the lab back in December of 2019, but I think it got out accidentally. What do you think?
Well, I wish that Marjorie Taylor Greene would close her pie hole, because every time she opens it, she has zero credibility, and it fuels the Chinese Communist Party that's basically saying that this virus occurred naturally. But the real issue that's going on here, George, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a bioweapon, and a bioweapon is a very real possibility here, because the SARS-1 virus, and, you know, I mean, this is just common sense, so you just pay attention to what I'm saying, that the SARS-1 basically infected 8,000 people, killed about 790 over a two-year period. This virus has killed about 180 million. It's infected 180 million and killed like 3.8 million. So there's no way that this virus occurred naturally. And you have people, like she's called for Anthony Fauci, she has a bill that she's trying to get passed to have Anthony Fauci ousted and his $450,000 salary saved for his participation in the creation, the funding of this virus at that Wuhan Institute of Virology. That chief virologist, her name is Xi Zhengli, okay, was out denying that this could possibly have happened and that she had nothing to do with any gain-of-function research. Well, Ralph Barrick from the University of North Carolina, microbiologist, worked with her at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and in her laboratory, they were injecting harmless bat coronaviruses with angiotensin II converting enzyme, ACE2, which is a blood pressure medication, and it created a monster super spreader human virus that the spike protein easily penetrates human cells. Now, if that's not creating a bioweapon, then what is? Look at the discrepancy in that last SARS virus and this one. So Fauci has been involved in, you know, Fauci says, oh, I never, we at the National Institutes of Health never funded any research on gain of function at the Wuhan Institute of Technology. No, what they did was they funded Peter Daszak's EcoHealth Alliance out of New York to the tune of $3.4 million, and he gave the Wuhan Institute of Virology over $600,000, maybe $1 million to fund gain of function research.
I just wish they'd all come clean, John, and they're just not doing that. Thank you so much. John Curtis. Well, the voice that you hear giving phone numbers, introducing all of the hosts on this program, Dick Ervasti, has died at the age of 66. He died of a stroke. He suffered it on May 29th. He never recovered. Our condolences to his wife, Mary. He will be missed. We will continue to use his voice for as long as we can. Just a great, iconic radio, television, movie voiceover artist. U.S. workers are some of the most stressed employees in the world, according to Gallup's latest State of the Global Workplace report, which captures how people are feeling about work and life in the past year. They simply say U.S. workers are stressed more than anybody in the world. General Motors will boost global spending on electric and autonomous vehicles to $35 billion through 2025, a 30% jump over its most recent forecast as it is beginning to push electric vehicles big time. Let's check in with investment advisor Charles Koppus. General Motors just running like crazy on this one, Chuck.
Yeah, that report came out earlier this year. I'm not so sure about electric cars, George. You know, there's about 300 million vehicles here in the U.S. Only about 3% are electric vehicles, maybe a little more in Europe. But this is really part of the U.N. Agenda 2030 for sustainable development to have zero emissions. And they partnered with the World Economic Forum and, of course, the new Green Deal here in the U.S. and so on. So everybody wants to do this. Biden says the greatest threat to the U.S. is global warming and everything, and he said that at the G7 meeting. You know, it's part of the infrastructure spending bill as well, rebates for these kind of cars. In fact, he wants to convert the entire fleet of government cars to electric vehicles. So that's his goal. And, of course, there in California, your governor, you know, he wants to get rid of all gasoline automobiles by 2035.
That's not going to happen.
And Senator Feinstein wants to get rid of all the gas automobiles in the United States, all of them. So I guess we're going to need bicycles. But the average cost for electric vehicles around, what, $35,000? Tesla's about $60,000 or more, $100,000. I mean, they sound really good, but how are they going to provide all the electricity for these cars?
And they only go for about 300 miles before you have to charge it up. But thanks a lot, Chuck. Chuck Koppus, his website is his name, chuckkoppus.com. He's also got a consulting group site, IDP Consulting Group. Nearly 46 years ago, Jimmy Hoffa, the embattled head of the International Brothers of Teamsters, disappeared. They still haven't found him. But in a moment, we'll be talking to one of the best investigative reporters I know, Dan Moldea, who has written a book called The Hoffa Wars. We're going to talk about Jimmy Hoffa, where he may be, where he may be buried, and also his potential involvement in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. James Riddle Hoffa disappeared July 30th, 1975. He was declared dead on July 30th, 1982. He was an American labor union leader, served as the president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters from 1957 until 1971. He became involved with organized crime from the early years of his Teamster work, a connection that continued until his disappearance in 1975. He was convicted of jury tampering, attempted bribery, conspiracy, mail and wire fraud back in 1964 in two separate trials. He was imprisoned in 1967, sentenced to 13 years. In mid-1971, he resigned as the president of the Teamsters as part of a commutation agreement with then-U.S. President Richard Nixon and was released later that year. But Hoffa was barred from union activities until 1980. He did not know that that was part of the deal. Hoping to regain support and return to the International Teamsters leadership, he unsuccessfully tried to overturn that order. Now, he disappeared on July 30th, 1975, as I mentioned, and he's believed to have been murdered by the mob and was declared legally dead in 1982. I may have been the last reporter to talk to Jimmy Hoffa back in May of 1975. He disappeared a couple months later. We were in Detroit, and I invited him to one of our television shows, and he graciously showed up. And then I walked him to his car, which was right out in the back parking lot of our TV station, and he was just telling me a little bit more on how he wanted to get back and become the president of the union. Tonight we're going to talk about Jimmy Hoffa, what may have happened to him, where he may be, and his possible involvement in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Our special guest is a specialist on organized crime investigations since 1974. He's a best-selling author, independent investigative journalist Dan Moldea, published at least 10 books, including The Hoffa Wars, The Killing of Robert F. Kennedy, Confessions of a Guerrilla Writer as well. You can find and track most of his work on Amazon. Dan, welcome back. It's been too long, my friend.
George, it's always a pleasure. This is 17 years since we last talked, so we're like the cicadas. We're coming back 17 years later.
And they still haven't publicly told us where Jimmy Hoffa is.
Well, I think I know, and I've been banging this tambourine for quite some time. I've refused to accept any money, and I've been offered a lot for the information that I've passed along, and I refuse to accept anything until the body is recovered and positively identified. I've pushed all my chips into the middle of the table on this one.
Dan, we're going to talk about this and possibly find out where that body may be. I want to say at the outset, you have talked to Hoffa's son, James P. Hoffa, who heads up the Teamsters Union now and has done so for a number of years. And I've met his daughter, Barbara Crancer, who was a circuit court judge in St. Louis before she retired. I want to just say at the outset, both of them are great people, and you know them.
I knew Jimmy P. And when I back in 1975, when you and I were, you know, looking for the white whale way back then, and you were at WJBK.
Yep.
And I was at first I was at NBC at WWJ. I think our offices were at WWJ, and
that's
then
right.
I went to New York with the network, and then I went with the Detroit Free Press. Let me ask you: were you there at the grand jury in December 1975? Were you there at the courthouse?
I did not go to the courthouse, nor was I summoned. I sent reporters there. We had a number of people.
You were the news producer at WJBK.
Executive news producer. That's right. So we sent a number of reporters there. Ron Sanders at the time. Vince Wade, by the way, says hello. He was at Channel 7.
I said hello. Vince is a great man.
Good investigator. But I was not there. But they had, I think the killers were at the grand jury testifying. They were there.
It was the Bergoglios and the Andrettas. In fact, I would later interview those guys. In fact, I had the only exclusive interview with them, 3.5 hours on tape. It was a remarkable time. Can I just do a little summary here?
Yeah, please. And then I want to talk about this JFK thing for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, what people view Hoffa and the law enforcement community views Hoffa's murder as a three-act drama with different characters in each act. In Act One, Hoffa went to the Red Fox restaurant to meet three people: Tony Giacalone, a Detroit mafia guy, as you know; Tony Provenzano, who was related to him, who's a labor racketeer out of New Jersey, and it was a capo in the Genovese crime family, as well as a labor racketeer named Lenny Schultz. Hoffa, there was no evidence that that meeting ever occurred, that in Act Two that he was picked up and that he was murdered, and then in Act Three his body's disposed of. What happened was, a few days after the murder, there was an informant named Ralph Picardo who received a prison visitation. Ralph was in prison for 20 years for manslaughter. He received a visitation from one of the alleged co-conspirators, one of the guys who would later show up at the grand jury.
Right, and he owned a trucking company too, didn't he, at the time?
Pardon me?
He owned a trucking company at the time.
I believe he did. I think he owned a local cartage company, but he was very close to the Provenzano family. In fact, he was Tony Pro's driver for a period of time. Anyway, during this conversation, the alleged co-conspirator, Steve Andretta, gave Picardo the basics of the case. And later, when Picardo flipped in November of 1975, he told the FBI that Hoffa had been murdered in Detroit. He had been stuffed into a 55-gallon drum. He was loaded onto a Gateway transportation truck and shipped to New Jersey. They said, did he say who killed Hoffa? And he said, no, I didn't say that. But I know as a fact that a guy named Sal Bergoglio, who was a top lieutenant to Tony Pro in Local 560 in New Jersey, that he did have a contract to kill Hoffa. And then the FBI said, did he say where in New Jersey he took them? And they said, no, he didn't tell me that. But I know as a fact from being with the Provenzano crowd that they would take dead bodies, murdered bodies, to a toxic waste dump in Jersey City, New Jersey, called Brother Moscato's Dump, a.k.a. PJP Landfill. Jeez. Brother Moscato was a reputed soldier in the Vito Genovese crime family as well, like Tony Pro. My job was, I had started investigating Hoffa and the Teamsters in December 1974, and so when Hoffa disappeared on July 30th, 1975, I hit the ground running. I was with the Wall Street Journal at first, and we went looking for Hoffa. I was 25 years old at the time, just a kid, and then I wound up with NBC News, where I stumbled across a guy named Roland McMaster. You probably remember him from your days in Detroit. He was a guy who was very close to Hoffa during the early days. And
he was a business agent for the Teamsters.
He was a business agent, and also he was a kingmaker in Local 299 there in Detroit.
Yep.
And he was also an international organizer. And on my first day on the job at NBC, I learned that McMaster, according to this source I had, and this, I've been in this for 46 years based on this conversation I had with this source, where he told me that McMaster had a role in the disposal of Hoffa's body. And he also told me that Hoffa was behind a series of acts of violence in Local 299 before Hoffa disappeared. Now, I bet you got some knowledge about this with your conversation. You were the last person to talk to Hoffa, and I bet you have some. Did he ever talk about the violence going on in Local 299 before?
He never did. All he talked about to me, Dan, was he wanted to get back into the Union presidency, thought he was railroaded, was admitted that he did not know that he was not allowed to have union activities until 1980, and claims he never would have accepted the deal.
See, I think that's kind of, I don't think he's telling the truth there, because
I don't think he would
have run over his grandmother to get out of jail. He was not doing well in jail at all. He would do anything to get out of there. And also, George, as you know, this guy was closed out institutionally from coming back into the union. The commutation restrictions on the pardon, let's say, that Nixon gave him, as you pointed out, in December 1971.
For a nice Teamster check, by the way.
That was ironclad, and he was not going to be able to get around that. And so what happened was also remember how the Teamster structure is. In order to be elected president of the Teamsters Union at that time, it wasn't one man, one vote like a Democratic union, like, as you recall, the great union like Walter Reuther and United Auto Workers or the United Mine Workers, or, you know, the one man, one vote, the bottom up union democracy thing. This was a top-down autocracy where, in order to be considered to be an officer in the international, you had to be a delegate to the convention, which occurred every 5 years.
Right.
And so Hoffa had to become a delegate to the convention, but he couldn't seek any union office, even a business agent in Local 299. And I bet you know Dave Johnson, who was his best friend in the union in Local 299 and was his caretaker as president of Local 299, who was prepared to relinquish that position to Hoffa the minute that the commutation restrictions came off, but they were never going to come off. So Hoffa institutionally was closed out from regaining the Teamsters Union. And so what Hoffa started doing was he started talking. He was talking to grand juries in Detroit. He was talking to congressional committees. He was talking to reporters like you. He was talking to Jerry Stanicky at Playboy magazine, who published that big story. And I think that finally
That's
came
right.
out.
He was a reporter at Channel 7 at the time.
He was at XYZ. XYZ, right? The ABC affiliate.
Yep.
And so that's kind of where Hoffa was. Hoffa thought he had been double-crossed by everybody. He was a complete paranoid at that point. And he decided that he was going to retaliate by talking. I believe he was silenced.
I think you're absolutely right. It was not just, I want to regain the presidency, and they didn't want him in. They were happy with Frank Fitzsimmons, who kind of turned on Hoffa. But
I got to ask you, George, what was his demeanor when you saw him? Was he?
He was cheerful.
He was cheerful.
Right. Small guy in stature, but brutally tough. I mean, you could tell. I mean, his handshake was like an iron fist. But he, you know, he seemed very cordial and very happy. And
well, I had been investigating the Teamsters since December 1974. I never talked to Hoffa, not even on the phone. And I had done an 8-part series on the Teamsters, their pension fund, and the Mafia. And for a little newspaper, I was a graduate student at Kent State at the time. And I had done this 8-part series for this little newspaper. And then a reporter for the Wall Street Journal named John Quitney called me. He says, listen, I'm doing a 3-part series on the pension fund. Can you give me a hand here? And I said, absolutely. I was honored. John Quitney's a great investigative journalist. And so I cooperated with him, and then his 3-part series came out on July 22nd, 23rd, 24th, and 1 week later, July 30th, Hoffa disappeared.
That's so right. Dan, hold on. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with Dan Boldera, one of the best investigative reporters out there, folks. He has investigated the Jimmy Hoffa case since the disappearance in 1975. We'll come back and talk about more of the Hoffa disappearance and the potential involvement in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Dan Boldera. His website is his last name, M-O-L-D-E-A, Moldera.com. And Dan, there's no question that Jimmy Hoffa, as he went up through the ranks to the presidency, was phenomenal for men and women who were Teamsters building that union. He did a great job for them.
Well, I think he was like Walter Reuther at first. He was a potential great working class hero, a champion of the working man, a hero of the rank and file. But then when he made his pact with the mob,
that's what happened.
Back in the early 1940s, he went from potentially a great labor leader to really nothing more than a labor racketeer. And that diminished him for the rest of his career. I mean, he tried to always pretend like he kept the mob at arm's distance. But, in fact, he was in bed with the mob from beginning to end of his career. And in the end, it was the mob that took his life away.
Well, he financed through the Teamster Pension Fund Las Vegas through the mob.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't think he ever said no. I knew some people who owned the Aladdin at the time who got Teamster money years ago.
Detroit people, right?
Detroit and St. Louis people.
Right.
And they did say one thing. They said that the Teamster Pension Fund did not lose money on the Vegas investments. What do you think of that?
That's Jimmy Hoffa. That was his legacy. His legacy was institutionalizing organized crime in America. I say at the beginning, on the first sentence of chapter one of my book, The Hoffa Wars, which came out 43 years ago, I said,
"Wow,
Jimmy Hoffa's most valuable contribution to the American labor movement came at the moment he stopped breathing on July 30th, 1975. And the reason why I said that was because when Hoffa disappeared, it was the liftoff of the federal government's refinancing, re-educating the movement against organized crime in America. It precipitated one of the biggest wars on organized crime ever launched after Hoffa disappeared, since the Kennedy administration, when you had John Kennedy as president of the United States. You had Bobby Kennedy, who was counsel of the Senate Rackets Committee, mm-hmm. 1957 and 1960, the McClellan Committee. Bob Kennedy was eating mob guys for breakfast back then.
Going after the Teamsters like crazy, wasn't he?
Absolutely right, George. And then when he became Attorney General under his brother in 1961, he started eating mafia guys for lunch and dinner too. Bobby Kennedy was the greatest crime fighter this country has ever had, and my respect for him is enormous. And
used to say,
and in the end, I think it was Bob Kennedy's war on organized crime which led to his brother's murder.
No, there's no question about that.
I was the first reporter in the Hoffa Wars to say that this was a mob hit, that this was Jimmy Hoffa, that this was a New Orleans mafia guy named Carlos Marcello, that it was a Tampa mafia guy named Santo Traficani, that they had arranged and executed the murder. And then a year after my book came out, the U.S. House Select Committee on Assassinations came out with its final report saying that Hoffa, Marcello, and Traficani had motive, means, and opportunity to kill the president. And the chief counsel of the committee, Bob Blakey, the world's greatest expert on organized crime, said the mob did it. It's a historical fact. I believe that then, and I believe that today.
And they all hated Bobby Kennedy with a passion, but they felt if you just go after Bobby, John, the president's going to come after us viciously.
Exactly.
So
right.
We got to remove him.
There was a month in September 1962 when an informant, an FBI informant named Grady Parton, came in and testified against Hoffa. And the reason why he decided to flip and turn state's evidence was that Kennedy wanted to kill Bobby Kennedy. Excuse me, Hoffa wanted to kill Bobby Kennedy. Not just Bobby Kennedy, but he wanted to kill his entire family with plastic explosives. And Carlos Marcello that same month was talking to an FBI informant, and he said to him, listen, if we decide, if Bobby Kennedy winds up getting killed, just as you said, George, that the president will get another attorney general and he will be ferocious on the mafia. So we've got to get, you know, we've got to get the president. And then Santo Trafficante was talking to another FBI informant, a guy named Jose Alamon, and during their conversation, they were talking about the 1964 election and that Kennedy probably had it in the bag that he was going to be reelected. And Trafficante said quite ominously, no, Jose, he's going to be hit, and Jimmy Hoffa is making the arrangements for the president's murder. And then the attorney for Hoffa, Marcello, and Trafficante, they shared the same attorney, a guy named Frank Regano out of Tampa, and he said that he had carried the message from Hoffa to Marcello and Trafficante to have the president murdered. The John Kennedy murder was a mob hit.
And it wasn't just Oswald, if it was Oswald at all.
As far as the shooting goes, I know nothing about that. That crime scene is a disaster area, and I have no idea what that one's about. The Bob Kennedy murder, that's a different case. I can discuss that. And that was, in my opinion, that was Sirhan did it, and he did it alone. I spent a lot of time with Sirhan. But on the John Kennedy case, the mob did it. It's a historical fact, just as Professor Blakey said.
Why do you think, in all this that's been going on, our government has not gone after the perpetrators, who most of them are dead now, but to get the truth out, to let us know exactly what you've been saying? I read your report you had in 2017 that you presented to the Mob Museum. Right. And it was, to me, this is the Warren Report. This is what should have been turned in.
Well, Trump had the ability, while he was president, to release all the files, and he made the decision not to release the JFK files. He made that decision. So,
what do you think's in those files, Stan?
I cannot believe that the Warren Commission people, I mean, you had Alan Dulles there, the former director of the CIA. You had this situation where it was understood that the CIA had been trying to kill Fidel Castro, that the CIA had been working with the mafia to kill Fidel Castro. And the same mafia guys who they were working with were the same mafia guys who hated John Kennedy. And I can't believe that if that had not become an issue, a discussion during the Warren Commission, then it wouldn't have created a whole new avenue of investigation for the Warren Commission. So, you know, the CIA, I know a lot of CIA guys, but they're all trained to lie. And, you know, I find very few intelligence reporters who aren't owned by their sources. And so as a consequence of that, it's, you know, it's something I avoid. When you're dealing with organized crime, as I do, I mean, it's easier to recognize the good guys from the bad.
And I think one of the other big problems, too, of course, is the way that they just continue. Hoover, who, you know, the FBI director at the time, was convinced from the get-go that Oswald was the lone gunman and refused to accept any conspiracy talk.
There was a lot of talk about Hoover and his conflicts of interest with regard to certain mob guys, and that he came to the table.
He never admitted the mob existed.
Well, he came to the table late, that's for sure. I mean, he admitted it finally, that there was a national crime syndicate. But once again, he came to the table late on that. And I think that's one of the secrets that Jimmy Hoffa was harboring. And one of the dangers, because remember, Hoffa was killed in the midst of the Church Committee hearings, which were investigating the CIA mafia plots to kill Castro. I believe, in short, that the CIA mafia plots to kill Castro, after they compromised the CIA and the intelligence community, the mafia had compromised the intelligence community. I think that it evolved into a conspiracy against the president of the United States. And again, I use a conspiracy, you know, with respect, because I investigate organized crime, which by definition is enterprise crime, crime by association. It is conspiracy crime. So as a consequence, I've investigated a lot of conspiracies.
I always have been thinking, too, up until your work, trying to figure out why would they kill Jimmy Hoffa if he merely wanted to come back and become the president of the Teamsters Union again.
I mean, think it's as you suggested. I think that he was talking. He was a threat to them, and I think as a consequence of that, he had to go. Now, the FBI had, after the grand jury investigation, and I was there at the federal courthouse that day on December 4th, 1975, when they had that hearing, and the Bergoglios and the Andrettis were there. The FBI took Picardo's information, the informant's information, and they went to Brother Moscato's dump, and they did with a search warrant, which they presented to the two owners of the dump, Brother Moscato and to Paul Coppola, his partner in PJP Landfill. And they didn't have a specific place to look in this 54-acre dump, and they just really couldn't do very much. Later on, after I interviewed Hoffa's killers, after I interviewed the Bergoglios and the Andrettas, I got to Phil Moscato, the underworld figure who owned Moscato's dump, or co-owned it with Paul Coppola. And Phil Moscato, he was giving me information with the frequency that a kosher butcher sells pork chops. But over the period of about 7 years, I had numerous recorded conversations with him, during which he told me that in Act One of the Hoffa case, that Hoffa was not picked up by Chucky O'Brien, his foster son, that Hoffa was picked up by Vito Giacalone, the brother of Tony Giacalone, who was one of the three men who Hoffa was supposed to meet that day, that in Act Two, that it was Sal Bergoglio who in fact killed Jimmy Hoffa, and that in Act Three, Hoffa was stuffed into a 55-gallon drum, loaded onto a Gateway transportation truck, and shipped to New Jersey, where he was buried at Brother Moscato's dump.
And you think he is there now?
What happened was that in February of 2019, I received a call from a gentleman named Paul Coppola Jr., who was the youngest son of Paul Coppola Sr., who was Phil Moscato's partner at Brother Moscato's dump. Paul Coppola Jr. is a businessman down in Florida, and he said that he thought that his brother might know something. His brother Frank might know something, and so obviously I wanted an introduction. That introduction didn't come until September of 2019, when I got him on the phone, and we had about six conversations over the phone, and then I said, we've got to meet, during which he gave me the whole story as to what happened.
Why would he do that?
His father had decided that it was his father who died in 2008. It was his father, Paul Coppola, buried Jimmy Hoffa's body. And he buried him at Brother Moscato's dump, actually off-site on Brother Moscato's dump, on state property, which is under the Pulaski Skyway, which is the bridge that connects Jersey City and Newark. And so Paul Coppola told his son before he died that he wanted Hoffa to be returned to his family, and that he encouraged his son to look for the opportunity to make that happen. And when he heard about me, and again, in my opinion, I own this case. He was talking to the right guy who knew what to do with that information. And so I said, let's get together. So I paid for him to come up to New Jersey, and he lives down in Florida. And he said we were having dinner with his girlfriend on September 28, 2019. And he said, listen, I'm going to go to the dump tomorrow. I haven't been there for many years. But he had told me, you know, the mechanics of what had happened. And I said, hey, man, you're taking me with you. And he said, sure. So he picks me up. We go to PJP Landfill. We go to where the spot where the body is. He shows, I've got a body camera on. I've got a hand in my phone. So I record the whole thing. He shows me the exact location of where the body is. And he says that his father had buried the body in the 55-gallon drum, and then he had put 15 to 30 barrels, steel barrels, on top of it. So then Frank and I were having dinner in January of 2020, and while we were having dinner, he was stricken and collapsed at the table in New Jersey. And then I said, come on, let's take you to the hospital. And his girlfriend was there, and she took him. He refused to go to the hospital until the following day. Then he was medevaced to Hackensack Medical Center, where he was put on a ventilator, put in a drug-induced coma, from which he never
came out.
And so he died on March 16th. So we were in a situation where my key source was dead. But I have a good friend over at Fox News, a guy named Eric Shawn. I'm not a big
fan of one of the anchor guys. Yeah,
I'm not a big fan of Fox News, but Eric Shawn is a good and trusted friend of mine, and Eric has really owned this case since 2001, as far as keeping it alive. Let me put it this way: Eric has kept this case alive since 2001 when he started working with Frank Sheeran, who was the inspiration for the Irishman, of course.
Sure. Who claims he shot Hoff in the back of the head, right?
It's a wonderful movie, bad history. It's like Oliver Stone's movie, JFK. Great cinema, terrible history. And so so Eric and I started working, and I have a team, Bo Carson from Carson Signature Films, Ari Mark from Ample Entertainment. Again, we're not accepting any money on this thing until the body is recovered and positively identified. I do not want any comparisons to what I'm doing with what Geraldo Rivera did back in 1986.
Yeah, that's right, in his vault.
With Al Capone's vault. There's no comparison there. I don't want anything unless I deserve it.
What can you do? What can you do to dig up that spot?
Well, what Eric and I did was we got ground penetrating radar. We went to the spot where Frank said the body was. It was 60 by 60 by 60 by 60 feet, about the size of a Little League baseball diamond, and the ground radar equipment detected a 12 by 15 foot field of steel drums.
Oh my God! So that part of his story is absolutely true then.
I've been cooperating. I mean, ultimately, I would be breaking so many laws, local, state, and federal, if I tried to dig this thing up myself. My team, Bo, Ari, and my team tried to dig.
Can't you get the feds to do it?
Well, I've been cooperating fully with law enforcement. I'm in a use it or lose it situation here right now, so I have been cooperating fully with the law enforcement community, and I at the local, state, and federal level. And this is with them now. I trust these guys. I know they're going to do the right thing. The spot is secure. And I think that the FBI has their hands full right now. I think everybody will agree to that. I think that they have some pending considerations that deal with what's happening right now in this century.
Yeah.
As opposed to going along with me and trying to solve this unsolved mystery from the last century. So I think they're going to pick their moment to do this, and but I'm in high confidence right now. I believe the body is there. I've written articles about it. There are photographs of it. If you go to my website, you'll see a couple of stories that I've done about it, moldea.com. And also, so we're just waiting to see what happens.
What a great story. Right, Dan, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and chat more and take some phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.